Hudson. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. And we're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm your host, Alexis.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Today we start our coverage with the Green New Deal Bill, which was introduced to New York State Legislature on Monday.
Then we'll hear from Mabel Leon of Women Against War in the special event this group has planned for Valentine's Day.
And later on, we'll have an interview with Aaron Summerlee and Kate Miller Corcoran from the Northeast Organic Farming Association New York Convention in January. The Palace Theater will host the Black History Step Show and Hippiest Dance Competition on Sunday, February 17th at 5 p.m. The Price Chopper Black History Month Step Show features some of the best step teams from the Capital District and beyond for an afternoon of high-energy performances. Stepping is truly something that needs to be seen to be fully appreciated. The quick moves and split-second changes showcase just how much time and energy is put into the choreography.
A life-size bronze statue of Harriet Tubman and William Henry Seward, commissioned by a group of Schenectady boosters to celebrate diversity and highlight a little-known friendship between the escaped slave and the statesman, has undergone a trial by fire. On May 17th, a dedication ceremony will be held at the remade bronze statue of Tubman and Seward. It will be installed in front of the Schenectady County Library at the corner of Clinton and Liberty Streets across from City Hall during a dedication ceremony. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Senator James Sanders and Assemblymember Felix Ortiz introduced a Green New Deal bill to New York State Senate to the New York State Legislature on Monday. We'll hear from local community leaders such as Senator Jessica Ramos, chair of the Labor Committee, and Senator Rachel May concerning this great new deal.
We start off with Senator James Sanders discussing his proposal for a Green New Deal for New York.
A group that is not known to be alarmist, NASA, has said that we are no longer about to do climate change, we are in climate change. They have recorded that since records have been kept, 18 of the 19 hottest years worldwide have occurred since 2001. Last year was the fourth hottest year on record. The consensus is in, the science is there. All but the most foolish would say that climate change doesn't exist. Everyone in their own lives can see that life is different. There's something happening when just the moment that they were born and just the life that they're living. So we're seeing that if we don't stop this, we're going to see more intense heat waves, prolonged droughts, spread of infectious diseases, rising sea levels, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I take this personal because I live by the coast. I represent a coastal community. We got hit by Hurricane Sandy, and we have not recovered. If you live in the Rockaways, as I do, I don't need to tell you about the chronic flooding condition that we have. I represent the lower ninth ward of New York City, of New York State, the lower ninth ward. That is an allusion to what happened in New Orleans during the Katrina disaster. And New Orleans never recovered, and I represent the lower ninth ward of New York City. Whatever's gonna happen is gonna happen to us first. We don't raise our voices. If we don't lead on these issues, they're going to write about us. The Hurricane Katrina superstorm, which destroyed much of New Orleans and the surrounding area, After Sandy, we had Hurricane Maria that hit Puerto Rico. My friends, we're seeing something happening, and when are we, the everyday person, going to step up and say, you know, enough is enough. Leadership must come from the ground. National Climate Assessment, which was released in 2018, a close to 2,000-page report, which was published by the United States Global Change Research Program, big name, for a giant problem. That organization has 13 different federal agencies in it, and they directly contradict President Trump's position that we don't know if the increase of global temperature is due to human activity. Lined in this report is that we don't have all day. There's only a short window that we have that humans can make a difference here. After that, the law of unanticipated consequences.
We hear from Senator Ramos, chair of the Senate Labor Committee.
Good morning, everybody. Science is real. Climate change is real. There's no sense in debating that. What we should be debating is how we're going to grow about addressing the imperative of solving reducing carbon emissions, of making sure that we are doing away with all of the pollution in our oceans, and so many other things that we as human beings have been contributing to. In my district, just some weeks ago, we experienced a transformer fire at a Con Edison plant. The Con Edison plant that has been producing dirty energy in my community for decades, resulting in very high asthma rates for our children, for our pets, for our elders, for every single member of our community. And so this really is a moral imperative to pass a Green New Deal in New York State.
Next is Senator Rachel May from Syracuse.
I want to talk about two other vulnerable groups. I represent Central New York, and we have a lot of farmers in my district, and farmers are trying to put food on the table, but climate change is a huge threat to them, as we have huge swings in temperatures and droughts and flooding and new invasive species coming up to Central New York. It is really hard for them to keep putting food on the table, and so our whole agricultural sector needs this Green New Deal as well. But the other group that many of us have hinted about, but I think we really need to focus on, is our children. I have worked for 15 years in environmental education, working with college students and K through 12 students on issues of sustainability and climate change. And our children live with a degree of anxiety that we cannot imagine. They are afraid of what their future is going to bring.
Reverend Peter Cook, who's the executive director of the New York State Council of Churches.
On behalf of the council and the 7,000 congregations we represent today, we are just thrilled to be here today to support Senator Saunders as he introduces this legislation for a task force to assemble a plan for a Green New Deal. You know, as I travel all over this state, I get to talk to farmers, I get to talk to people in poor communities which have been disproportionately affected by environmental degradation. We just see so many problems, and yet sometimes we have a failure of imagination to address those problems. We get into our own silos, and we don't keep our eye on the moral imperative to take care of the earth. So this Green New Deal is inclusive and comprehensive in its vision. That's why New York State needs to form an inclusive task force like the one proposed by Senator Saunders, which has the proper authority to receive and process expert testimony from all sectors, all sectoral task force, because of its inclusive nature, would be able to consider and enhance proposals which are already before the state.
Alex Beecham spoke on behalf of Food and Water Watch.
You know, we're excited as Food and Water Watch to come here and support this legislation because it truly addresses the massive scale of the crisis we find ourselves in. We don't have to debate the science. We're living through climate crisis every day, and we need real solutions, that address the enormity of that problem. So here's what that means. We need a fair, swift, and just transition completely off fossil fuels by 2030. And we need to stop the construction of new fossil fuel plants all across the state. You know, we don't have years and years to push this off anymore. We can't wait till the middle of this century to solve the problem. We need strong action, and we need it immediately.
Dr. Margaret Klein Salomon.
But I realized that there is an asteroid heading towards this planet that's going to kill us all, and that basically the whole country is crazy. And we're talking about whether it's real, whether fixing it would be too expensive, or whether we can take decades to deal with this asteroid. But the answer is pretty obvious, actually. We are in danger, and we need to do everything that we can to solve this crisis. We do not have decades to reduce emissions.
Our last speaker is Howie Hawkins, former Green Party gubernatorial candidate.
For the Green Party, I campaigned 3 times for governor on a Green New Deal for New York. And this bill embodies key points that we were talking about. The first thing is it's science grounded and sets the right deadline for a decarbonized clean energy economy of 2030. A lot of people, the United States government, countries around the world, most of them out of the Copenhagen Climate Conference in 2009. The bill, the Climate and Community Protection Act, the Assembly's passed 3 times. They're going for 100% or 80% by 2050. And that's based on a goal that's really was designed by politics, not science. The way we got to 2 degrees Celsius as the so-called danger point was that originally scientists said, well, what if we double the carbon over pre-industrial levels to 550? The climate model said that'll get you to 2 degrees. And by the time they got to 2009, they said the model said, no, it'll be 450. But actually that year, actually 2 years before that, James Hansen at the Goddard Space Institute and his colleagues and other climate scientists around the world were saying, no, if you get to 450 parts per million in 2 degrees, climate inertia and feedback loops are gonna take you to 3 or 4 degrees anyway. And that is climate disaster. That's dangerous. That's not just heat waves and stronger storms. It's undermining agriculture, the destruction of ecosystems, general impoverishment, mass migration, social conflict, and war over dwindling resources. That's what dangerous climate change means. So the climate clock is running down. And what the scientists like James Hansen said is industrial states like New York have to get to this 100% goal by 2030 if we're going to have a hope of staying within the climate that we call the Holocene, where agriculture was able to be done and was the material foundation for human civilization. So that's the stakes, and this bill meets the deadline, and that's really important. We got to deal with reality, and that's what the science tells us.
That was Senator Jessica Ramos, Senator Rachel May, Reverend Peter Cook, Alex Beecham, Margaret Salomon, and Howie Hawkins, leaders of community groups such as the Climate Mobilization and Food and Water Watch, discussing the issues surrounding the Green New Deal.
If you're putting a chair in the spot you just dug your car out of, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and the group Women Against War have something special planned, and you're invited. Steve Pierce speaks with Mabel Leon, member of the group.
We start off with
what I'm here to talk about today is one of our committees called Grannies for Peace. And it's one of my favorite groups, so I'm very glad to talk about it. Grannies are a bit less threatening than some of the other groups, but I say that's quite deceptive because we're very strong. And that's because we're motivated by love, and that's what this action is all about, because every Valentine's Day we have an event dedicated to love, not just personal love, but love that goes beyond each of us individually to our communities and the world.
So what are you planning for this Valentine's Day?
This Valentine's Day, we're going to be assembling at the corner of Wolf Road and Central Avenue from 4:30 to 5:30. And our theme this year is love, not bombs. End the war on Yemen and the genocide and starvation and cholera epidemic, and stop supplying Saudi Arabia with bombs, armaments, and intelligence.
And why did Grannies for Peace choose the Saudi war on Yemen as the focal point this Valentine's Day?
Well, we wanted to acknowledge that it is a war led by Saudi Arabia, but the bombs that are falling on the people of Yemen are United States bombs. And all the armaments that are there are supplied by the United States. And our bombs have been responsible for deaths at funerals, at weddings, at marketplaces. And our U.S. bombs even bombed a school bus, killing dozens of children. So we want the armaments to stop. And it's really our bombs that are doing the killing. And right as we're speaking today, there is legislation being brought up in the House of Representatives to pass a resolution to do not sell any more armaments to Saudi Arabia and end the war in Yemen.
And this seems like such a huge problem. There's so much money involved and such major corporate and government players. What can the individual American do about this?
Well, as I just said, calls can be made to your representatives today because the House of Representatives is introducing a resolution which they think they're going to pass. And actually, in the last session in the Senate, controlled by Republicans, they passed a resolution to not sell any more armaments to Saudi Arabia. And a bit of that is the reaction to the very blatant murder of the journalist who was working for the Washington Post and this administration's absolute inability to acknowledge that that happened. So we do think that there is a chance to make this happen. And the way there's also many other issues in addition to just the bombs. Because of the intense bombing that's occurred, the food supply has totally been disrupted. And there's mass malnutrition and starvation in Yemen. And I will just give you the latest figure on starvation of children. And I think most people that read newspapers saw a photo of this child suffering from extreme malnutrition, and she died of starvation. 85,000 children have died of starvation already in Yemen. And this is 2019, right? And this is something that we're all aware of. If we are aware of such an atrocity, we need to stop it. And there are 14 million people are suffering from extreme malnutrition and could be facing starvation. To make this even more horrible, humanitarian aid was delivered to one of the ports in Yemen, and there was supposed to be an agreement on a ceasefire, but the ceasefire did not occur, and the bombs have continued so that it is not safe to transport the humanitarian aid of grain to the people that are starving. So that delivery of grain is now rotting in a port in Yemen while people are going to face death from not having food.
Well, that's an amazing story there. I think people are aware of the fighting in Yemen on a certain level, and I think they're available. They may be aware of the suffering on the ground amongst civilians. I'm not sure how widespread the knowledge is that it's American armaments that are causing the problem.
Yeah, it's been, well, although our president has bragged about the wonderful money deal that he got, and that is a difficult thing for Americans to oppose when there's money to be made. However, this is an issue and a time, I think, when we really could get action to end this. And so every day that goes by, there are more deaths. And in addition, there is, I think the statistic is 29 million people in Yemen do not have access to clean water or sanitation. And that's because of the bombing. And that has resulted in an incredible epidemic of cholera. In fact, the World Health Organization says that this is the largest epidemic of cholera that has ever been reported since records were kept on the disease of cholera. And there's a million people infected and 10,000 new cases every day. The World Trade Association says this is the most severe humanitarian crisis in the world at this moment.
So what can people, or how can people, find out more about Women Against War and the project Grannies for Peace, and especially your annual Valentine's Day vigil?
Well, what I would, first of all, extend an invitation to people to come to our event 4:30, out in the cold, and we will be at the corner of Wolf Road and Central Avenue, and we have many, many, many banners, which love, not bombs, end the killing of children in Yemen, end genocide in Yemen, end endless war. And so we welcome people to join us. And our hope in terms of doing this at a very heavy trafficked area is that we may build some awareness, because Yemen is a long way away. It's a long way away from our individual lives and our individual comfort. But it is a disaster, and our country shares responsibility for it. Therefore, we must do something. And we're doing this, actually, in the thought of Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day is the holiday of love. Well, we're celebrating not only personal love for our children and grandchildren and families, but a concern and love for children of the world. And specifically, we're focusing on the disaster in Yemen.
That was Mabel Leon of Grannies for Peace, a group focused on creating peace for the people of Yemen.
And for those whose hearts have gone into AFib because they just realized Thursday is Valentine's Day, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen on demand online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone you want to pick with us, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. And I just saw our DJ making coffee earlier, so it's going to be a great show tonight.
We'll hear from local volunteers Aaron Summerlee of the Rural Health Network of South Central New York and Kate Miller Corcoran of Volunteers Improving Neighborhood Environments about the South Central New York Fruit and Vegetables Prescription Program.
So this is Dave Pueblo, and I am at the 2019 NOFA New York Conference.
I'm Amy Halloran, and I was at a presentation with Kate Miller Corcoran and Aaron Summerlee, who spoke about some programming in and around Binghamton that's really taking advantage of the necessity to get a healthy and just food system. So, Aaron, I'm going to start off with you and ask you to describe this program and help give people ideas of how to kickstart some healthy food access work in their community.
Thank you. So the program that we were just speaking about is called the South Central New York Fruit and Vegetable Prescription Program. It's operated by my organization, the Rural Health Network of South Central New York, in partnership with a lot of different organizations and healthcare providers. And the program model is designed to increase access to local, healthy, nutritious food for individuals with different chronic illnesses. And so people are referred into the program by their healthcare providers, and they receive vouchers, the financial resources to spend over the course of a six-month program with local farms. So it could be farmers markets, mobile grocery store, rural grocery stores, and the farm share program through Vines.
Great. And Kate, can you describe Vines and your work and intersections with this?
Sure. So Vines stands for Volunteers Improving Neighborhood Environments, and we are a local nonprofit to Binghamton, New York. We have a number of ways that we are trying to create a sustainable and just food system in our area, including community gardens, our urban farm, our summer youth program that encourages our local youth to come work at our farm. We do a lot of Green Thumb workshops that are to educate our folks that are getting involved with our community gardens and our programming, and then of course Farm Share. And Farm Share is a weekly subscription to a box of locally sourced vegetables.
Great. So it's kind of a CSA for on a low-income profile.
That's right.
Can you describe the community partnerships involved in this? Because it is really a big spider web happening to make this change.
Right. So our community partners are really essential to, they were key to developing the program and then really instrumental in being able to offer it. We provide, the overarching program model and support and administration, but it requires having our healthcare providers. So we currently work with two different hospital systems. We'll be expanding that in the future. So the support of the hospital systems, we work with primary care offices and the nutrition department's registered dietitians and other, professionals within those doctor's offices. And then, of course, we need to have a whole bunch of different farm and food business partners to have places for people to shop. And then different community partners like Cornell Cooperative Extensions and the health departments, and of course a nonprofit like Vines, who provides another type of food retail option.
Right. So can you describe the flow if someone comes in to a healthcare environment presenting with chronic diet-related disease? What's the route to good food that you create?
So when someone comes in, they could be, they could be an existing patient who's seeing a dietitian, or they could be, seeing their physician, and they have, certain health risk factors, and are also, they get screened if they're food insecure as well. And if they'll be told about the program, if they're interested, they can get enrolled, and then they'll receive their first packet of vouchers. So that's what they'll use to shop at the farms. And then they get all kinds of information on where to shop, how to shop, help if they need it with transportation, another program that's offered through the Rural Health Network. And then they can go out and do their shopping as they would, like in their normal life, and then they can participate in different educational programs through Vines or elsewhere. And then after about 2 months, they'll come back and have another meeting with their healthcare provider, where we'll check in, see how things are going, get more support, get another packet of vouchers, and continue that cycle until the end of the six-month program.
That's really great. So it's a very fiscally supported enterprise. Instead of a doctor just saying, eat better, you're creating a pathway so that someone has the resources to do that.
What we've found is that a lot of the providers talk about it really, and of course it has an impact on health, but it also really changes the dynamic of that relationship, that patient and, you know, healthcare provider interaction, rather than just, you know, being advised to do something and then feeling potentially guilty or feeling bad about yourself for not doing it. People get this resource to actually act on it and make those changes. So it creates a really good tool for engagement and building a positive relationship.
It sounds really dynamic. Yeah, that's so great to know about. And Kate, can you tell us a bit more about Vines helping these communities access?
Yeah, sure. So we try to have our distribution locations where we're handing out vegetables in different food deserts across our county, so that people who have limited income and limited access have more access to fresh fruits and vegetables. We do that not only through having the sites at those in the food desert, but we also are able to provide a 25 to 50% discount for folks who are income eligible. So this takes a share that would generally be $80 a month, and it takes it down to $40 a month, which is much more affordable for people that are living in low-income situations. And we also try very hard to provide a lot of member education, just like Aaron was talking about, teaching people how to use their food, store it short-term, use it easily, and then also store it for the long term.
Right. And one of the strategies you mentioned was having cooking classes led by volunteers who are in the distribution. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. So we have a lot of great, great volunteers that work for us that are creating relationships. They're seeing people every week at distribution. And they do cooking classes also. And we have very high attendance at those classes. As I mentioned in our presentation, when I do a class, it's not as well attended as if one of our volunteers is doing a class, because they already have those relationships. And they also, many of them are living in economic hardship. So they know the little things that you can do, how you can go to this store and get, you know, this item for cheaper, and you can bring it into your home, and this is how you can use it. And so it's really awesome that they can do that.
Sounds like a great bridge. I love to see it. So I know that your program has been going 2017 and 2018. And are you looking forward to any growth or changes in this year? Aaron, I was talking to you. Sorry. So here's Aaron again.
Yes. So the program that we've been running, we're going to be doing it again in 2019. We are looking to expand the number of slots that are available in the Broome, Tioga, and Delaware County side of the program that we're doing. But we're also right now talking with partners in some surrounding counties and the hospital systems in those areas who have a lot of interest. So right now it's really just in the planning phases, but hopefully in 2019 we'll also be able to work with some partner organizations a little outside of Binghamton to expand and replicate and create new versions of it. And we're also, you know, we're always trying to refine and improve how things go. So one of the things I mentioned in the workshop we gave is that we're looking at ways, you know, transportation being a barrier, but sometimes it's not just about being able to get, you know, not about not having a car and that's your limiting factor of being able to shop. A lot of individuals might be homebound. And so, you know, what different delivery models could we try to innovate and add some different components to the program to increase access?
Great. And Kate, what are you looking forward to in this winter storm pause before we hit the growing season this year?
Oh, I'm very much looking forward to expanding our reach with our discount and just bringing more families in that can use this and learn about how using and eating fresh vegetables is not as difficult as it seems, and especially once you have the access to it. So we're excited to see more families using our program.
So I have a question. I participated as a grower in a startup farmers market in the south end of Albany this past year, and we had very inconsistent results. I was working very closely with an organization called Takes a Village, and they'd done a lot of outreach into the community and put various incentives in play, like some were health oriented, like you would, if you took a yoga class, you would get a $5 coupon. Others were like heavily subsidized fruits to try and get the kids in there. Also, they worked with the medical community. They had like a clinic that came, and that was almost a surreal day because you had basically 50 people in white coats and maybe 5 or 6 people from the community who actually showed up. So my question is, food deserts exist across the state, and each community is unique, but if you're starting something up like that, what are the steps that you guys think might be most successful to be transferable to these different communities?
Well, I think how we have the most success of people participating is using our relationships with partner organizations. So people are seeing their mental health providers. They're seeing, they're going to classes maybe at a church, or they're going to classes at a elementary school where their kids go. So those folks that are running those programs already have trust and relationships with the people that will be using your program. So if you can connect with those organizations and tell them what you're doing, and they can give that information to people that you want to be participants, that is a great way to start to engage people, because they have that trust already.
Yeah, I would add, I think, well, Kate didn't mention this, but in the way that, you know, you talked about in the workshop, the way that FarmShare was developed was that the whole structure of it was influenced by that community member input. And so I think that's important too in participation, because it was designed, you know, based on what people wanted, how they wanted to shop. And similarly with the fruit and vegetable prescription program, people have a lot of choices in how they shop and where they shop. And I think that helps. Well, that's part of it. It helps because it, you know, if you don't want to shop at the farmer's market, you don't have to. You could shop somewhere that's more convenient for you. But then also, I think a part of it is like the dollar amount, right? So is it enough of a coupon to actually incentivize you to go do that? And I think that's one of the powerful things about this model. Obviously, it takes more resources, but it's enough money that it's like having a significant behavior change.
Right. It's not a joke of an ask. It's a serious ability that you're handing people to pay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great.
So we're almost out of time. How would people contact you if they were interested in learning more?
So for the fruit and vegetable prescription program, our website is www.foodandhealthnetwork.org. So you could find all the contact information there.
And for Vines, we are at vinesgardens, both of those are plural, .org.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Erin Summerlee and Kate Miller-Corcoran for that piece on food justice and the South Central New York fruit and vegetable prescription.
Foodstock 5 is a local benefit for the food pantries of the capital of the region. Correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with Bob Gamaki and Mark Emanation about this project.
Mark, you've been a musician for a long time. You're the leader of Soul Sky, and you've been in many bands over the years. Yep. But you also work at the Oakwood Community Center. Are you still doing that?
Yeah. I help out down at Oakwood Community Center, and we have that house is, amongst other things, the Troy Larger Pantry. And that's a pantry that's open every Saturday morning. And you can only go once a month. It's open from 9 to 11. You can only go once a month for a representative of a family. And we have like 60-plus families every Saturday. And a couple Saturdays we've run out of food beforehand. And it's heartbreaking when someone shows up and they don't get food, because the next pantry that's open is on Monday, at Unity House, so they have to wait till Monday. And we see working families, people that are working these jobs that pay less than a living wage. And as we know, it costs an enormous amount to live in the Capital District. Rent's through the roof. Wages aren't through the roof. We have a lot of elderly folks that the solution isn't just getting a better job because they're past, you know, to a degree, their working age. And we have disabled people, and we have lots of children that we're feeding. So it's a good feeling that we're doing this, but it's a shame that it even has to happen in the richest country in the history of the world.
So how does food stock work? Bob mentioned that all the door proceeds go to the cause, and there must be a lot of proceeds because the event goes Sunday from, oh, I don't know, what is it, from 2 to 8? So it's hours long, and there's six bands. You got a great lineup there. Does the money go to Oakwood, or does it go to the food pantries? How does that work?
It goes to the food pantries of the Capital District. And we've thought about this, Steve, over at Bob and I have been talking about it.
Mark had suggested them because they distribute to all the other pantries. So that's why we selected them, because we thought it would be the best way to really spread it around the community. And the other thing about is that we decided that it would just be a good way to do that, to bring them into it. And so they have become the one that we wanted to go to. Initially, I thought of going to the Rensselaer Food Pantry, and Mark had suggested that if we really want to make an impact, that's what we should do. Now, the one that we just had recently in November, Food Stock 4, brought in $1,700 at the door, plus 54 pounds of food. So we're very proud of that. We think we can do better. We're hoping to do better.
So Food Stock takes place on Sunday, February 17th from 2 to 8. It's in this cool bar in the northernmost reaches of Troy, right? The Rustic Barn mm-hmm. Pub.
Great music joint.
Yeah, the real deal. The stage is really nice, and it's very intimate, and good sound system and all that. It's a great place to have a show. And if folks want to get more information about that, what should they do? Should they call the Rustic Barn Pub, or is there a website? How does that work?
Well, they can go to the Rustic Barn Pub on Facebook, and they could call the Rustic Barn Pub. They are a pub, so they have pub food if someone's hungry. And they also sometimes will provide a 50-50 and other things to provide more for the pantry itself. So it's
They're really good people, Jody and Jason, that own the place. And they, you know, if they weren't willing to do this, it would have made it hard to have Food Stock 2, 3, 4, and now 5. And if Bob wasn't willing to put all this effort in, and more bands volunteer and want to play this than we were able to do in it. And
well, actually, Mark, they weren't the first. When I first asked them, I couldn't get a date from them, so right. I was looking elsewhere. And I had a couple of other locations, but then I was having a little trouble because I didn't want to rent a PA system or anything. The thing about the stage at the Rustic Barn is it's a stage that people want to play at. There's great lighting. They've put in a lot of money on their stage. Their sound system is awesome. And Jason, who is one of the owners, has become so good at the soundboard that we all love to play there. It's just a great place to play. So it just turned out that they are our host, and it's worked out really well for us all.
So this is an event that takes place on Sunday, and it's going to benefit the families in the Capital District, the many families in the Capital District who depend on the food pantries for just day-to-day life. I was struck. I had a chance to interview some of the folks from the food pantries, and just the sheer number of pantries around the Capital Region is staggering. And there's so many people doing this work. How many are there as a ballpark?
The food pantries in the Capital District have 64 pantries. There's 18 in Rensselaer County. There's 7 that are affiliated just in the city of Troy with them. And the thing that's good about this is every dollar that's donated is pretty much matched by $6. Basically, you're buying $6. I don't mean that. You're buying $6 worth of food with every dollar that you have. And so you're really, you know, $1,700 sounds great. And it also, compared to the need, is like, oh, geez, $1,700. But it buys so much more. And if you're going to come and bring perishable food. Bring it that's in the boxes so it's not as heavy to carry as the cans. Don't just bring us your old sauerkraut. Bring us some pasta and peanut
dry
butter.
Dry beans.
Yes, rice.
So I think people who aren't, you know, on the front lines of the struggle against poverty and malnourishment have an idea that's based on the public perception around Thanksgiving and the holidays. But we're talking about a pervasive daily need. This is people who just are not making enough money to eat.
That's right. I mean, you know, I grew up in this area. What used to be a $400 apartment is now a $1,000 apartment. But your wages didn't go up to $1,000 wages. And so I know people that are working multiple jobs and have multiple families living in a flat together that are trying to, you know, survive in this thing. And if something happens, like you lose a week or so of pay, we saw this just recently with the government shutdown, that the food pantries, and thank goodness for them, both the food pantries of the Capital District, Regional Food Bank, Unity House, United Way, everybody opened up their doors to those furloughed and displaced workers during that time. We're working without any pay, like the TSA folks. And so we just see this great need. And, you know, I protest a lot, as everyone knows. But I also think sometimes you could yell at the light bulb that ain't working, or maybe you could work together to just change the light bulb. And so this is a modest way of changing the light bulb for at least a little bit. And I salute, like, I know some of these folks, like Linda O'Malley here in Troy at the Oakwood, and Angela Warner at St. Vincent's in Albany, that put their heart and soul in this for years. There was no food pantries in the United States from 1946 to 1980, very few. Reagan coming in and, you know, butchering the social safety net, which has been continued by pretty much everybody since then, has led to these things. And some folks that started these food pantries in their church in 1980 are still volunteering so many years after that. So this is our little way of being able to help it. And musicians, we're not the smartest guys in the world or gals in the world, but we can help, and we have fingers.
Well, one thing I could say about it, though, is this wouldn't be possible without the local musicians. I've supported them for years. I think people should go out and support their local musicians, and they are a big part of this, and it could never happen. Food stock could never happen if it wasn't for our local musicians.
Mm-hmm. So we have about a minute left. Can you just go over the lineup that you have on Sunday?
Well, on Sunday, we have a great lineup. It's a local musician who plays locally, Brian Kane. Ties is a band that I put together with some friends that play. We play some original songs and some covers. Mike McMahon, who many people know, will be playing with Luke McNee on sax, and Saul Sky, of course, and Night Train, who's a local band who plays around, and Lou's Blues. It's a new band. Leslie Bachman is a piano player and wrote the songs, and it's just been recorded. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this lineup.
Great. So that's this Sunday at the Rustic Barn Pub in, is it Spiegeltown? It's right on the border.
It is Spiegeltown. It's just Lansingburg. Up the hill, yeah. Really, from Lansingburg and the back end of Troy, yes.
Okay. And for folks who want to find out more about the food pantries, is there a website or someplace people can go?
Yeah, the food pantries in Capital District have a great website. Just look that up, and there's tons of volunteer opportunities, and they list all of the pantries and all of the places you can go to get if you need help.
And I understand they actually have a click on. If you want to donate right away, you can donate to the food pantry by going to their website.
Okay, fantastic. We'll see you on Sunday.
Thank you very much. Steve.
That was Steve Pierce with Bob Gamache and Mark Emanation discussing the upcoming Food Stock 5 that takes place this Sunday, February 17th from 2 to 8 p.m. at the Rustic Barn Pub in Spiegeltown.
Now we'll hear from Alfonso Rodriguez concerning the local nonprofit Youth Build and the positive effects it has on at-risk youth in the capital region.
Tell us a little bit about Youth Build for those who aren't in the know.
So Youth Build is a program that offers an alternative to the traditional public school system for young folks age 16 to 24 who just didn't find much success in that setting. They really didn't take a liking to the traditional school model. They decided that an alternative would be best for them. And Youth Build provides that alternative, an alternative for them, in that we help them with their HSE, their high school equivalency, the task tests, helping them with some accreditations as well, so that once they graduate the program, they also have a couple of certifications, which gives them the leg up in the workforce and the job market out there. And that certification is the NCCER, the National Construction Certification and Education. I forget what the R stands for, but yeah, that's what their certification is. And it helps them with like being certified. And it's a national accreditation, so they can move anywhere within the United States. And if they are employed with some place that takes NCCER, they would have that. It'll just be like walking in, as opposed to, yes, I have to verify that you're capable of what it is that, you know, you say that you are. You have your certification, boom, you're ready to go.
Now, we've worked with Youth Build for a number of years here at the Sanctuary, and I always think of it as a Capital Region program, but it's actually nationwide, isn't it? How many of them are there? How big is this?
It started in the Bronx with, I forget the woman's name, but she started it. It was just like a radical like program, just like, all right, we're just going to take charge of our streets. Nobody wants to fix up these buildings. We're going to do it. And they started it up. Since then, in the 70s, it's now grown to be, like you say, across this, across the United States. I don't know the numbers on the like full, but here in New York State, there's 20 Youth Build programs. So across New York City to Buffalo to like all up and down Hudson Valley, and even right here in, at home in Troy, we have about 20 programs in Youth Build. So,
how did you get involved with Youth Build?
I saw that there was a opening for the construction skills instructor, and it was a very unique intersection of all my skills and interests, in that my background is in the private sector, working with Turner Construction for 5.5 years as a construction management employee. I was working as a project super, a project manager, and it didn't really like fulfill me in the ways that I was looking to be fulfilled. So after leaving Turner for a year, taking some time off, just kind of regrouping, I found that there was a construction skills instructor position, and it was just a unique intersection of all the skills that I'd acquired in, you know, my time at Turner, as well as just like all my sensibilities and wanting to like be a fixture in the community and helping out and give back to communities that look like me. So yeah, seeing that, it was like, of course, I've got to take advantage of this opportunity.
Now, it took me a little while to tumble onto this to realize that Alfonso Rodriguez might be related to Don Fons, the rapper. Is that you?
That is me. Yes, I am the rapper.
And how does that connect with what you're doing at Youth Builder? Not, you know, directly, obviously, but just in the whole life picture. How do you make these things work?
Yeah, it helps with framing who I am as an individual, a human being, and giving back to the community and seeing the folks who I want my music to affect, seeing the folks who I want my music to help empower, to help radicalize and revolutionize, you know, who they are as people and how they view themselves and can help, you know, others view themselves.
So the young people you work with at Youth Build are, for the most part, have dropped out of school and they've come upon hard times for one reason or another. What is the game plan for you when you start off with you have a new group every year? What do you do?
Well, we put them through a 3-week intensive called Mental Toughness, and it's just kind of who you are as a person. Let's see how you'd fit, what kind of group dynamics pop up, and then we start to see how they would interact with one another. At that point, we accept usually 20 folks, sometimes 20 to 25. But most times the cohort is about 20 folks. And then we'll start them out with the introduction ceremony and a 2 to 3 week probationary period, to which if they've passed all this up to that point, so like a month and a half, they'll be accepted into the program. And then we'll start programming from there with HSC academics and construction for the NCCER.
So just as hip hop and construction seem like a odd mix, high school graduation and construction skills seemed like it could be difficult. Not everybody's into both. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes, yes. There's varied interests with some of the young folks. Some of them want to get into nursing. Some of them want to be entrepreneurs. Some of them want to be rappers themselves. So there's that kind of unique intersection of, oh, yeah, here's our interests and all the things kind of being there. But there's also a Construction Plus, which exists. We don't have it here in our program, but it exists out in the United States. And we're looking at how do we implement a Construction Plus program here in Troy. But what that is essentially offering other kind of programs as well. Some of them starting off that we're looking at is the nursing business, as well as photovoltaic, which is like solar panels and how to get those installed.
Okay, and what are the challenges you find working with these young people?
The number one challenge is breaking down the mental barriers. Here's how I've seen myself for so many years. Here's how I've been kind of put down. Here's how I've been let down. And really coming to the ring for some of those young folks and standing up for them and standing up to them, because they're kind of their number one enemy a lot of times. And just kind of reinforcing them, saying, hey, you can do this. This is doable. Like, look at so many folks before you and look at everything that you've done even up until this point. Like, you're making strides. Just like, keep it up. Keep up that fight. And yeah, that's that tough part, that making them believe in themselves when a lot of times they've been told and reinforced not to.
And what kind of success do you have with that? Do they believe you when you believe in them?
Not at first, but over time, a couple folks have started to like come around, and you can see like the spark start to develop in their eyes. I had one student earlier today tell me a success story about how she recently got an apartment. I was just like, yeah, like this is amazing. Let's like celebrate it, do something. And it's just like, oh, I still have some moving in to do and you know, all the things. And it's just like, yeah, this is amazing. This is dope. I'm so happy for you. And just to hear her like talk about herself in a way that she does now versus when she first started, like, I'm not even sure I'm going to be here, to being like, yes, I'm all about this positive energy. I'm trying to welcome as much of it into my life as possible. I'm here for this. To hear like that, those two bookends, just like amazing.
So this program takes a little bit less than a year to go through the whole thing?
Yes, about 9 months, which interestingly enough, it's like being reborn. Yeah.
And what should people do if they're interested in this, or if they know somebody who might be? What's the way to get involved?
Number one way is to check out our website, ceoempowers.org. That's ceoempowers.org. And you can click on the Youth Build tab, and it'll take you through the application process as well as some more information about the program itself.
Okay. And anything you want to add? What should people know about Youth Build that I didn't think to ask you?
People should know that Youth Build works, and that if there is one or there's a possibility for starting one in your community, support it and help those young folks who need that extra push, because these are great young people who have so much potential that just need to be molded a little bit differently than we've been traditionally doing.
Now, I alluded to your hip-hop background at the beginning of this interview, and I've been meaning to ask you, do the young people you work with know this about you?
They do. They do, yes. Yeah, we've had a couple rap battles, actually. Yeah.
And do you think that helps your credibility with them?
It does when I win. It does when I win. Other times, it's kind of like, oh, yep, there you are.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming out.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Alfonso Rodriguez and Steve Pierce for telling us about the positive influence that the Youth Build program has on our local youth.
All good things must end, and so must the show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Our engineer tonight is Jonah. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. And you can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07, held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.